As Surrealism turns 100, what can it teach us about the importance of dreaming and creating a better society? Will we wake up from the consumerist dream sold to us by capitalism, and how would that change our ideas of utopia?
Sylvia Kostowska is an author and historian, and she focuses on modern political thought and critical social theory, especially the Frankfurt School and utopianism. She is currently a professor at York University in Canada. In this episode, we discuss both her fiction and nonfiction pieces, The Eyelid and Utopia in the Age of Survival Between Myth and Politics.
Sylvia Kostowska, welcome to One Planet Podcast and the Creative Process.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me and finding me, first of all, because I'm not as maybe easy to find as some of your other invitees.
Well, before we dive into your book, Utopia and the Age of Survival, just tell us a little bit about your upbringing in Poland at the end of the Cold War and how that shaped your visions of utopia in the modern age.
So I grew up in Poland in the 80s and the very early 90s. I left when I was 19. And I also spent a couple of years in the States. And I say this because as a child and adolescent, I had a taste of both worlds, as it were. I experienced the cultural contrast between the West and the Soviet bloc in Eastern Europe. I was in the U.S. when Chernobyl happened, the time of the nuclear power plant disaster. And the taste of the West that I got left an indelible impression on me, in the sense that I was first amazed by the sheer abundance of commodities and that commodity culture, that constant stimulation of the desire for the bigger and the better, truly left an impression on me as a young person and contributed in more ways than I can even name to the education of my sensibility. And also it was the freedom of expression that I, even though I was very young, I felt to be different from what I was used to in Poland in school, the encouragement that I received in New Jersey. So this was a brief period, but it was very important. And then in 1989, of course, we had the first quasi-democratic elections, parliamentary elections in Poland, and we were the first country to do so in the Eastern Bloc. So it was the end of the so-called communist era, and my family rejoiced because they supported the Solidarity movement and they distributed samizdat literature. My aunt was a librarian, and she would show this to me, and this clandestine literature. So I understood the fear of surveillance and the regime of fear that the adults around me lived through and the breath of fresh air when the elections happened and when the transition began. And in 1990, my father took me to Berlin. And so this was as the wall was coming down, demolished with bulldozers and hammers and pickaxes by ordinary people in the street. And I saw this as well. And I thought this was very symbolic. So witnessing these transitions, these very rapid two transitions made me think that the possibility of change, even in apparently prohibitive circumstances, remained a real possibility. And maybe that's what made me a natural candidate for utopian thinking, for embracing utopian thought. And I grew up seeing a dream of change being realized. And then maybe I went on to see every such dream as potentially effective.
That's really interesting because, yeah, a lot of us have skepticism about utopia, or you also address how utopia is used in a marketing way. But I think that utopia, it is possible. There are practical routes towards utopia. You had seen, well, let's say it's not utopia, but you'd seen those changes. It's just how we have to manage our expectations in order not to oversell the dream, so that it stops us from doing anything because then it's unachievable. You know, I'm really interested in the way technology is changing how we communicate with ourselves and our imaginations and how we perceive and engage with the world. It's, of course, heralded these new visions in utopia, a future where people won't have to work, a future where all thinking, dreaming, and human relationships will be done for you. So what is your critique on these new visions and the changing role of writers and artists in the age of AI?
AI, of course, there's AI, the existing AI, and AI, the dream, the artificial general intelligence that is aligned with our values and that will make our lives better, that will certainly, the dream is, the techno-utopian dream is that it will lead us towards utopia. Well, it is the means of organizing human collectivity, human societies in a way that would reconcile all the variables, all the things that we can't reconcile because we don't have enough of a fine grain behind understanding of how people interact, you know, the different motivations of their psychologies and of societies, of groups of people. Of course, that's another kind of psychology that we're talking about. So I think the dream of AI is a utopian dream that stands correcting, but it is itself being corrected by those who are the curators of that technology. Now, you asked me, what is the changing role of artists in this landscape? And I would say, first of all, that I'm for virtuosity. You know, and this makes me think of, again, AI on a higher level, AI, it would be virtuous before it becomes super intelligence. Yeah, so. But I'm for a human virtuosity, and really unqualifiedly so, because I'm not for virtuosity for its own sake or for the sake of selling a piece of art. It's not something that is meant to add value to a work of art or to a work of literature. In literature, mastery is not of obvious value, this virtuosity, this mastery, unless it's self-effacing, because otherwise it comes across as pretentious. And until machines can pull it off credibly, I think writers will continue to be appreciated, if only by a shrinking number of readers. That's certainly something that we have to contend with. And maybe by other writers, because I think that the decline of literary readership is irreversible, and the kind of interest in big novels and long-form journalism as well. Now, where AI comes in is, of course, it can produce content that isn't supervised, as it were. That isn't, not necessarily, even though writers today use it to create and work with it to generate ideas and so on. But once it's unsupervised, and this is, of course, coming, we will be in a different paradigm altogether. It's not clear to me who will read the books that are produced by AI or their audio versions, because reading takes time that no one really has anymore. You know, we get our news in abbreviated text and bite-sized videos. It's not clear to me that writers in the age of AI will be as important as they are today.
Yes. And of course, you are a novelist as well. We'll talk about The Island, but we're staying on this point of utopia. You lay out a history of utopia. We have a lot of misconceptions around it. And your real critique is more along the political, social lines, I think, more so than the AI.
So the book Utopia in the Age of Survival was really an intervention to, kind of, I would say, axiological intervention to serve as a reminder of certain values that unite the left across a broad spectrum of the different currents in left thought. And I focused on two things. I focused on utopia as a myth, and not as a political myth, but as a social myth, in the sense that goes beyond politics. Utopia is a metapolitical myth. And I'm not talking about all utopias, because this utopian thought has undergone transformations, and we went from something like a state-based, therefore political utopia, to more open, dynamic, and more anarchistic versions of utopia that have become more and more appealing. And in my book, I also communicate my preference for these latter kinds of utopias that are not state-based. I use the term body utopias because they are really anchored in the individual rather than the collective, and something like, you know, the abstraction of society, the all, they rather arise from the individual and the individual bodily needs, desires, how the two interact, of course. And from there also, they take into account our individual differences, you know, our individual bodily differences, individual psychological differences. And I use the term myth for utopia because utopias have began really as myths, are anchored in myths, the myths of the golden age, the myths of paradise, and more recently, the myth of revolution, although that is more modern, the more modern utopianism that is fed by the revolutionary myth. The myth of utopia specifically is a speculative myth of where society is headed. And I think that socialism, so left-wing thought and socialism within which we find anarchism, can be united around this idea. Now, on the other hand, you mentioned utopia as a marketing strategy, a tool, and of course, capitalism also uses utopia and also refers back to the source of utopianism in these other ulterior myths to sell us things to make us less critical of it, and therefore to put to sleep our critical capacity. And to talk about utopia in a time when utopianism is really in, because it is in our capitalistic culture a term widely used to sell a vision of a better body, of a better interior, better space to inhabit and a better society, of course, still as well, and a better future for the techno-utopian crowd. This is a very useful term to turn around, as it were, to turn the tables on and use and recover some of, in fact, its left and revolutionary force, because utopianism, even though it had not been the most favored term of socialist intellectuals, thinkers, revolutionaries in the 19th century, is certainly present throughout their thinking, even though they are not claiming to be utopians, but in fact, even distancing themselves. I'm talking about Marx, for instance, in Marx and Engels in the 19th century, or even Charles Fourier, who is also in fashion more recently as providing different answers to the question of utopianism and creating a different myth of utopia from that of communism in Marx and Engels, and different again from the earlier myth that is the city utopia of Thomas More, who is the originator of modern utopianism as we know it, this idea of an island, of a utopian island reserved for just some. Yeah? And so just to conclude on this point, to take back the term of utopia, to also rehabilitate a bit this idea of myth, which has been tarnished by 20th century ideologies. I try to do this in order to find the broadest possible sort of common ground for left thinking today in North America specifically, but not just, because I also spend a great deal of time in France, and I see that there are many, many things that these political scenes have in common. There's a lot of overlaps.
Yes, and so you talk about us being in this kind of marketing coma. How do we wake up out of this to pursue realistic goals?
You're right to talk about waking up, even though in my fiction, I, of course, highlight the value of sleep and dreaming, because without sleep, we can't really dream. Without sleep, we can't be relaxed when we wake up. We can't think straight. Therefore, we can't really wake up if we don't sleep. It's quite clear that we need the relaxation to combat the anxiety that we are living with more and more on a daily basis, specifically the anxiety around labor and around the environment. So in order to wake up, we need, first of all, to find the time to sleep, in order to find the time to then reflect in a calm fashion and to put things in perspective once we are called upon to participate in a society that we feel is breaking down every day, more and more so, disappointing us in so many ways. And part of the problem is that we are always seduced by this idea that things are going to get better because now we have technology. And as much as we know the risk and there is an anxiety connected to that, you know, what will technology bring? Do we know? No, we don't know. We're in the dark here. Yeah. We also leave the lights on and we hope that it will in fact solve many things for us. So we're led to expect a lot of things and we're constantly disappointed and constantly frustrated in that expectation, in that, you know, utopian expectation in many respects.
It's funny because I was just talking yesterday with the cinematographer Benoît Delhomme. You may know his work. He made with Julian Schnabel that beautiful film At Eternity's Gate about the life of Van Gogh, starring Willem Dafoe, and also The Theory of Everything, starring Eddie Redmayne. And he's just directed Anne Hathaway and Jessica Chastain in the psychological thriller Mother's Instinct. And so as a cinematographer, he's always thinking about light and dark. And he posted something, "We're all afraid of the dark." But I think that, as you point out, it's kind of this ceaseless daylight that we should perhaps be afraid of, constantly having to be vigilant, or the surveillance capitalism for surveillance society, which doesn't leave us where we used to be afraid of the dark. We should perhaps be afraid of too much light and our every movement followed or required each moment to be learning or doing, never really sleeping and dreaming. How can we imagine better futures?
Mm-hmm, yeah. And the prospect of sleeplessness and therefore of dreamlessness, and again, this connects to daydreaming and the inability to imagine utopias and alternative futures. This prospect is frankly terrifyingly real. I'm not the first to say this, of course. Many, many have warned us that where we're headed as a society, we're headed straight for insomnia. Yeah? And the need to produce, the need to always be on standby in a global system that we are creating is, of course, connected to this. You know, it's not just the video games that are keeping us up, or Netflix or something like this. We are creating the structure that is ensuring our sleeplessness. And we don't yet have the waking pills that will make us feel all right in this insomniac future. but they're coming, I'm sure. And if we no longer are able to recuperate, we're no longer able to handle the stress, we will hallucinate sleeplessly, as AI does nowadays, hallucinate, and we'll make errors that only the machines will be able to fix for us. At least we will hope so. And this, of course, opens up to the dystopia of human extinction, right? When we lose control of what machines do, and we won't be able to align them with our values.
Yes. And so everyone's trying to figure out how to align them with our values, including the developers and owners of AI, although there may be many things that they haven't told us. And I don't mean to bring in technology so much, but I guess that's one of the more pressing problems, that and the environment that we have to think about. So do you have ideas about how to align them with our values?
No, I don't really have ideas, because the technology to me is quite inscrutable. So in terms of practical ideas, no, I think just more awareness, more education on the dangers of not aligning AI. And, you know, and yes, a moratorium is not a bad idea, right? That's something, but it's just not realistic. Let's put it that way. And not in the current climate of where there are also advantages to advancing AI as quickly as possible because of its potential applications that can save lives, et cetera, et cetera. So it's really a free for all. And without being overly pessimistic, I don't think that it will transform the world into utopia ever. I don't think technology and AI specifically will bring us to where we would like to be. There's always, and there has long been, the danger of technological capacity, technological progress tipping over, turning into its opposite, the kind of dystopian nightmare that novelists have long been imagining. And that exists at every point. What's called the dialectic of emancipation by French philosopher Miguel Avancour, the idea that we can be headed for paradise and produce hell.
Yes, we're victims of our own imagination. And obviously, when technology can do it at such a pace without reflection, I think that's the real problem.
So with the things that we were just talking about, I really resonate with your ideas about technology and how it has helpful potential, but maybe not the potential to lead us into some sort of utopia. And so I wanted to bring in here critiques around academia and academics and this ability to theorize, to talk about utopia, because we've been talking about utopia for a long time, but what does it actually look like to put that into action? What does it look like to put your ideas from utopia in the age of survival into dismantling a capitalist system or exploitation or environmental degradation, overconsumption, like we talked about? What are those kind of baseline practical applications that come from that theory?
Let me think, because it's a very rich question. It's a very good question. So maybe I should start with returning to my work, so my academic work, but also my fiction, because the two are intricately connected. So my novella, The Eyelid, is where I put some of these ideas into images, these ideas that later I developed in the book on Utopia and the Age of Survival. I like to think now as of utopianism as effective social daydreaming. And I'm using an expression of effective dreaming that from Ursula Le Guin's novel, The Lathe of Heaven. I like this definition of effective social daydreaming because, of course, utopia is associated with consciously imagining societies. I also want to bring daydreaming back to dreaming insofar as our dreams are wish fulfillments. Our night dreams are wish fulfillments. And in this novella, I explored night dreams and their utopian potential. So back to effective social daydreaming, utopian ideas are embodied in our actions, in our criticism of existing society. And I like this quotation from a French liberal 19th century, Lamartine. Utopias are often only premature truths. Or another way of putting it is that what is imaginary tends to become real. And that's another quote I'm pulling from the founder of surrealism, André Breton. So we dream, we daydream of a better world. And this could be a very vague daydream. This could be a very free-floating kind of reverie. And the idea of utopianism that I'm putting forward in the book is not a detailed model, orderly, rational model of the city utopia, but this free-floating, desirous model of the body utopia, which isn't finished, which is always imperfect. It's always in transformation. It's not complete. No, it's not perfected. It's not complete. So these dreams that we have and daydreams that we have are guiding our actions, are influencing our day-to-day behavior, if we let them. And I would like this certainly to be more the case. But in any case, our imagination is always involved in creating reality. And the opposition between the two, reality and fantasy or the imaginary, is not a stark one.
Yeah.
They're porous. So I've just mentioned surrealism. And in recent years, I've turned to surrealism. I found in surrealism something like a mirror of aspects of my sensibility and a history with which I remain in dialogue. So what is surrealism? Well, most people mistake it for an aesthetic movement that's long over. And all we could do is celebrate it this year. It's a 100-year anniversary of the Manifesto of Surrealism. So we'll celebrate it as a finished movement. And in fact, it still continues. And so this living movement is what I'm a part of. It's surrealism's emphasis is on the unconscious workings of thought. So on the unconscious or semi-conscious, a reverie is that kind of semi-conscious state of daydreaming. And so I find in surrealism a very important piece of the puzzle of what attitude we should take in order to live in a more utopian fashion, utopianizing fashion, as I call in my book. Not utopian, because we're not creating utopias. I don't go as far as to say that we are creating utopias around us, but I do say that we are living in a utopianizing way if we daydream of a better society that includes not just us or our family, but includes everyone, because a utopia worthy of the name today is universal. It's all inclusive. It's not an island somewhere for the happy few, for the rich, or for the poor, for that matter. It's not restricted. So my interest in surrealism is, I think, absolutely necessary. I talk about surrealism in the book, but since the book came out, it has taken on a greater importance in my day-to-day life. And I am actively involved in and on the front line of the French surrealist movement in an effort to keep it alive, in an effort to remind the public that it is still alive and very much an international movement, as international as it has been in the past, and that it's staying true to its principles, to its beginnings. And it's not just an aesthetics. It's also an ethics, and that ethics is utopian.
Yeah.
Its ethos is utopian. It's an impulse to create the world, to refashion one's life, and to transform the world into a desirable one. So we don't argue for violence. I say we, as a surrealist group of Paris, we don't argue for violence. We want the imagination to be empowered. The imagination is not a gift. It's something that we need to conquer. It's something, not even conquer. Conquer is not, doesn't have the right tone to it, but it's something that we need to cultivate.
Yes, it's kind of, I don't want to say tragic, but it's unfortunate that the great steps forward that the surrealist movement made historically, and I guess now not as many people understand that it's a living, breathing movement, have really reached the widest audience through advertising. People who are selling the utopia without actually perhaps believing it, but just as a means for encouraging more consumption to those who don't benefit from the utopia themselves, but give little bit of packaging, this temporary moment of satisfaction, not even pleasure, but just consume instead of actually living a real, imaginary, and fulfilled life.
Yes, and the lure of the ersatz. The beauty of capitalism is that it awakens our senses. It creates things that we didn't know we needed, that we didn't know we desired. And there is a confusion between, of course, what we need and what we desire. But much of what of this abundance is unnecessary abundance. And I say unnecessary because I'm, of course, thinking of the limited resources that the earth provides. So I think the imagination helps us to find abundance, richness in ourselves and in our response to what are limited resources. And after this long period of capitalist exuberance, it still continues. You know, it's enough to just walk down the street and you'll see the quantities of installs along the street, the quantities of sneakers that all look more or less the same, and they're cheaply produced. It's all plastic. And of course, the desire is solicited there, is awakened in the passerby to have another sneaker, another product that we don't need, but that has a certain allure of adding quantitatively, of course, but the allure is that it will qualitatively transform our life. But all it does, of course, add another pair of shoes. Maybe a silly example, but I was struck by this when I walked down the street in Saint-Ouen, in a suburb of Paris, and looked at the number of sneakers specifically on display that people were buying. And, you know, I wasn't buying, but certainly I respond to this because it's shiny, because it's colorful, because it blinks, and so on.
Yes, I believe something like 23 billion pairs of sneakers or runners are produced every year. And it takes that imaginative leap just to see beyond the kind of, well, virtual slaves behind in the factory systems that are producing them. So solving that, I won't go into it.
No, this is exactly aligned, I think, with this question. You mentioned Le Guin, and she's one of my favorite authors. I think she brings some really interesting ideas that bring ethics and utopia and fantasy all together in this beautiful soup. So I was wondering, specifically with The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas, which I think is one of her most well-known stories, a lot of people read it here, kind of what ways her ideas of Omelas are still relevant to society and to conversations around utopia, that idea of a society that is perfect in all ways except for the child that they keep in a basement, or I guess in our case, the slavery that is producing the sneaker.
Thanks for that question. It is a story that I've thought a lot about, and the beauty of it is that it presents us with a society that is a mirror image of our own, at least that things haven't changed very much since she wrote it in the 70s, but that we don't recognize as our own society. Well, of course, our society is built on many children in the basements that are sort of scapegoats that are the sacrifices of our luxuries. So I think the message in that story is absolutely relevant to today, more and more so, I'd say. The walking away, a very ambiguous ending, because of course, the ones who walk away from Omelas, they're walking into the dark. They are either engaged in a refusal or in self-erasure, in a kind of death, social death. They walk away from a society they can't bear, but it's not clear that they are able to create a counter-society that will be an improvement on the very wonderful society of Omelas, except for that one flaw. Yeah. And of course, there is a Christian dimension to the story that the child is a sacrificial victim of the society. But it is a story that reflects capitalist society, American capitalist society engaged in wars and, of course, spreading violence to far-flung parts of the world that citizens of Omelas, as the citizens of America, pretend not to notice. So those who walk away are those who are dissidents, who protest wars. And of course, we have these protests today that are very much, very much about walking away from a society that does not assure its own principles, that its own principles, its own values are defended.
So, and this is a kind of point that might be interesting, especially to Devon and her generation. Sylvia, of course, you're an educator, you know, what your reflections are on, well, both the future of work and the future of education, and considering all these rapid and vast advancements in society that we've been talking about and AI and technology, how do you foresee the future of education evolving to prepare students for the uncertainties of the future of work?
Yes, I'm in a moment where I'm going on sabbatical, but we just had a strike in our university, York University in Toronto. The strike was by sessional instructors and graduate students. So what's going on is in my university is symptomatic, of course, what's going on across universities in North America and elsewhere. And that is the dismantling of not just unions, but of liberal education and therefore an education for citizenship. So in particular, humanities and social sciences are affected in my university, for which the humanities and social sciences have, you know, made its reputation. And so this gutting of liberal studies, and in particular, my field, humanities, will set us back considerably, I think. And on the one hand, of course, university administrators are responding to shifting priorities by students who are themselves, of course, dictating what courses are on the books offered this year and which are put on the back burner. On the other hand, you have generative AI that is interfering with and eroding the core of educational benefits of these programs, my program, because it relieves students of the tasks of research, of critical analysis, and writing. So what I see, I think, sort of, and I'm not a prophet, but what I see is a return to the one-on-one private tutor model that, of course, was a model in the 18th century for the aristocracy, then the bourgeoisie. And this will, of course, be a model available to the rich, and they will receive an education that is more complete, whereas, and even private institutions will, you know, move away from what isn't profitable. Private institutions that are still collective and industrial scale educational institutions, they will be reducing programs in response to declining enrollments. So what we're seeing is a kind of chain reaction because there is increasing economic demand and insecurity, precarization of labor. This means that young people are making different and more strategic choices, and they will be less and less motivated to pursue disinterestedly, non-instrumentally, the programs of study like my own. But it's precisely in the utopian spaces where thought, free inquiry are still possible and encouraged that students can learn to put things, to step back from the chaos that is society today and to get some distance on the anxiety that they feel, to see what's wrong with life and to think of how it might be fixed. And without these spaces of learning where we can exercise the social imagination, and me as well as a teacher, I exercise my social imagination in speaking to young people, we all risk being overwhelmed by the mounting dysfunction, social dysfunction. And yeah, it may be that teachers will be replaced by machines. For now, there's just speculation, but for the foreseeable future, the quality of higher education will continue to decline. That's my sense.
Yes. Well, I'd heard some of those rumors too. And Elon Musk doesn't help with the pronouncements he makes about, you know, robotic teachers.
This is Devin Mullins, and I just wanted to take a minute to talk about utopia from a couple other cultural perspectives. We've talked about Ursula K. Le Guin, we've talked about journalism, we've talked about a lot of these real-life consequences of dreaming and of thinking of utopia. So I wanted to talk a little bit about this section of utopia called Afrofuturism. Afrofuturism was coined by Mark Derry in 1993 in his essay Black to the Future, and it is this entire genre that has been created of art and music and philosophy almost that ties back to specifically the African-American diaspora in the United States. And it's looking at envisioning a science fiction or fantasy future from the perspective of the culture and lives of African Americans. There's a lot of attention paid to the impacts of slavery on the culture of African Americans and on history in general that is not usually focused on in sci-fi and fantasy. There's this attention to reclaiming these cultural touch points for many people and taking a critical eye and looking at the world as is and saying, what would this look like if it had not been colonized? What would this look like if we did these things differently, if we changed these systems, if we asked questions in ways that we have not yet asked questions? Those things all come from that Black diaspora in the United States, and it's a really incredible area to study. I took a class on it last semester with the incredible Dr. Keith Leonard at American University. I learned so many things. We listened to Janelle Monáe, who is a pop and hip-hop artist who does incredible work with a visual album and has done some acting and received more than 10 Grammy nominations. We listened to Sun Ra, George Clinton, Parliament, Funkadelic, all of these incredible bands. Within visual art, you have people like Basquiat who are making Afrofuturist art. Within novels, you have Octavia Butler, Parable of the Sower, is an explicitly Afrofuturist text. And all of these can provide kind of a way of thinking about the world in a utopian vision, or in an alternative future, that is one that white people in particular, non-Black people, have a really hard time imagining because they don't have those same cultural contexts. So because white people don't have those cultural contexts quite as often, I think it's quite interesting to bring Afrofuturism into discussions about utopia in general, because we can compare and contrast what these different visions of the future have, why we have different visions of the future, and how we can combine and collaborate to make a better world for everyone. Now, back to the show.
Yes, I believe many of us are forgetting the pleasures of appreciating the arts and living an examined life. And it's not just the information, it's what you do with that information. I think that if we are also lucky, we could have that one-on-one tutoring or that wider educational family, which is not about remembering things at such rapid pace, but reflecting upon them. And I don't even like that word implementing, because it's about function as opposed to being a whole person or a whole artist. And of course, it's not just education, because everything's become a marketplace. And one of those marketplaces that is really affected is, of course, journalism. You know, we're facing a lot with the spread of misinformation and erosion of trust in institutions. What measures do you feel can be taken to just keep journalism alive? Which is, if you're not being educated in the universities, the other way. We were being educated, but now
I don't really have an answer of how we can keep journalism alive. I think there is a responsibility by governments to keep journalism alive. And I said, it's not as easy as that because people prefer to get their news from TikTok or in short form. And so much of this journalism goes unread and deep fakes populate feeds and people prefer visual information. So they will, of course, be duped into, again, it's a free for all. Yeah? And it's not that we're post-truth because we still value truth. We still value objectivity, even though, you know, that's been put into question by gonzo journalism. We value this. Yeah, I don't give as much credit to this idea that we're living in a post-truth moment. We're still living in a knowledge economy and we're still epistemophilic. Yeah, we love knowledge. But there is a shadow economy. There is an ignorance economy. And as I said, knowledge requires time and we are slaves of capital. We don't have the time. And so despite our insatiability, our thirst for knowledge as a commodity, we only have the time and the means for partial or even false knowledge. And so we are drawn to theories that explain, that package things for us into neat explanations where they're conspiracy theories, where we get a kind of a handle on what's going on, rather than wading through all this mass, still great mass of journalism that is produced. We prefer to scroll videos and images and where these kinds of conspiracy theories proliferate. So I'm not very optimistic. And without government intervention, without the state, that we can keep journalism alive, because it just doesn't sell anymore. And there are kinds of solutions that papers have been coming up with in order to keep that journalism alive. But let's face it, the number of journalists is declining by the day.
Yes. I mean, I agree. We have to find a way, a revenue stream for journalism. But even by saying the state, well, then that opens up a question about state-sponsored journalism too, which is also something we want to avoid.
Problematic. Yes.
Indeed. Yes, we're not quite in a post-truth world, but with the deep fakes, it's just a full-time job just weighing through all that. And it's hard to believe your eyes, like you used to say, seeing is believing. And now it's like, I'm not sure. What am I actually seeing? Who made this? What's behind it? So I don't know, what's your overall vision, your political, social vision of a realistic utopia might be?
I don't have such a vision. I only have glimpses of what I desire, that I daydream about, or that I see in, as I said, more recently in surrealist literature, in surrealist art, because I also, of course, like to look back on the heyday of surrealism. I'm currently co-curating a major exhibition of surrealism, the 100 years of surrealism. So I'm very much in this moment where I'm trying to explain, you know, to the public the value of this movement. And another connected movement to this, as I said, is anarchism, which rather than projecting utopias, what you said, just realistic vision, you know, of the future, anarchism prefers to talk about prefiguration in the here and now of the world as you'd like it to look. So it's a very experimental approach, this prefigurative approach. It's a very experiential approach to utopia. It's modeling, but of course, in your own individual way, and creating communities as well, of course, of shared values. Yeah, like communities of shared ideals of how to be, how to behave with one another, how to live together in a way that is sustainable, that is not anarchistic in the bad sense, but that in which some anarchy, as Élisée Reclus said, anarchy is the highest expression of order. So that is the ideal for anarchism. And that order is not the rationalistic top-down model of the city utopias of the followers of Thomas More. And Thomas More himself, the founder of utopia, is misunderstood because his utopia, it's only part two that's read and people think utopia is a blueprint. But of course, it was much more complicated for him. It was a play. It was a game for him, this utopia that he imagined. And I think imagining utopias, so imagining the myth of utopia, projecting utopias and allowing them to be destroyed simply. And this is the kind of iconoclastic utopianism that I developed in the book. This is the vitality of utopianism today, the pluralism, the plurality of utopias and the combating of any dogmatic utopias that may arise. Resisting the kind of the blueprint model, resisting the recipe for the future, one final version, as it were, the winning version, resisting that impulse and just constantly proliferating images, glimpses, as I say, of a better society.
Yes, of a better society. So always within utopia, it's one that is, by implication, it's man-made. It's a kind of design or returning to an original design in which everything was in equilibrium. On the reverse of that, we think about pristine nature, which may no longer exist. So I'm wondering what your reflections on the beauty and wonder of the natural world are, and utopianism within the natural world in which we live in, within balance of our planet.
I think that we should not be under any illusion that we can return to some pristine earth. Right? We have to do the best we can with the earth that we have inherited, our generation and those of our children. But we should not therefore say, well, it's all lost. You know, species are becoming extinct as never before. We should not sort of become pessimists because there is no other alternative, because we've been robbed of this idea of the pristine nature. I think nature has not been pristine. People speak about the Anthropocene. I don't quite like this term, but the idea that humans have been transforming nature and have been altering it, adulterating it, is something to put into perspective, this nostalgia for a pristine nature. And utopianism actually goes hand in hand with nostalgia, in the sense that nostalgic longings have long fed into utopian imaginaries, right? I mentioned the myth of the Golden Age. This was something that used to exist, the Golden Age, right? Or paradise, an idea of nature, again, pure nature in harmony with human beings. These imaginaries, these are nostalgic imaginaries that feed into and can reactivate a utopian thinking in our day. And what is recurrent is the harmony with nature. I like one particular myth, a utopian myth, and that is the myth of cocaine. It is not a man-made utopia. It actually is nature that creates abundance for us without us having to lift a finger. And this idea is very ancient. It goes back to ancient Greece, and it therefore precedes this modern utopia of man-made society, which organizes its own production of resources and the exploitation of nature. Right? And so a return to this is by no means just nostalgic. It can also be utopian. And we just need to, as I put it, reactivate these myths. And there are many other myths, utopian myths, that we can, of course, reactivate. But the myth of nature is very powerful. We should by no means let go of an idea of pristine nature. And I don't think also just to return to this idea of species extinction, I don't think that the de-extinction efforts are particularly utopian, even though they may seem this way. No, how do we compensate for the material loss of biodiversity? I think no amount of technological ingenuity will actually fulfill this desire for a return to the pristine nature that we have lost.
Yes. And as you reflect upon the future, you know, education, in that kind of world we're leaving for the next generation, what would you like young people to know, preserve, and remember?
I'd like them not to limit their world to content they can find on the internet. I think that's a real danger. Many of my students say, well, I haven't thought about this. I haven't read this because I didn't find it online for free. And I do want them to remember that not all knowledge is digitized, that much remains in the depths of the ocean, elusive to the nets of the internet. In its effort to make knowledge accessible on one platform, right, to create this kind of enormous encyclopedia, of course, Wikipedia is a particular expression of this. So in this quest, we also reduce the past to the present. The past is more virtually present for us than for any other generation in our lives because it's available online in the form of textual and audiovisual archives. But this proximity actually affects the past's pastness. Yeah, it's kind of bygoneness. What Walter Benjamin called the aura, this appearance of distance, yeah, that it had happened long ago, that it's not just something that is collapsed into the present. Yeah, and that distance is lost in the digital reproduction, whether it's paintings or archival documents, photographs. I think it's erroneous to think that everything that is extant from the past is at our fingertips and that we don't have to go out and look for it. Yeah. Even if a lot of it is, it's not lossless, that reproduction. Not to mention, you know, that the carbon footprint of the digital footprint, this is the downside of the accessibility of all knowledge. So yes, it's curiosity. This is what I would like to pass on. Curiosity about the past shouldn't stop at the digital, at the virtual. It's really tempting to think that all the answers are already there online because it's so vast, this web we are spinning, but it's not the case.
It's a really important point that we have to cultivate that curiosity for the present and the past and even understand, just go to the primary sources and even understand that within that there's a lot that's between the lines. And that comes from the critical thinking that you celebrate so well in your work. So thank you, Silvia Krostowska, for offering your visions of effective social daydreaming and giving us a history and critique of utopia and the world we live in. By better understanding these imaginaries, we can do more with the life we're given, and we can pursue practical futures. We all live on one planet we call home. Thank you for adding your voice to One Planet Podcast and the creative process.
Thank you so much to both of you for questioning me, for being here, and for having the conversation and continuing the conversation.
One Planet Podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk and Devin Mullins with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interview producers on this episode were Sophie Garnier and Devin Mullins. Associate text editor was Sophia Reeser. One Planet Podcast is produced by Mia Funk. Additional production support by Katie Foster. Theme music is written and performed by Juan Sanchez. We hope you have enjoyed this program. If you'd like to get involved in One Planet Podcast and be a part of the climate change solution, just drop us a line at team@oneplanetpodcast.org. Thank you for listening.